Hey, this is Eagle and Vice. This is episode 20. How about that?
You've got a real attitude problem, McFly. You're a slacker.
Hey all, it's Mike, your humble host for Ego and Vice, as always. Nice to have you back. This is episode 20. Fuck, can you believe it? Fuck, can't believe it. Got this far. Chris Landry was on the show, shit, I don't know, 8 episodes ago or something like that. And he wanted to come back and interview me, and I said, yeah man, we'll do that for episode 20. But I think I'm going to push that to 25 because I got a bunch of guests lined up. I've been actually making plans and actually calling people ahead of time, not just the day before, calling my friends like the day before saying, hey, man, you want to be on this thing? I've actually planned ahead probably about a month and a half. So 25 might not even work. Maybe we'll aim for 30 because they're just kind of rolling off. When you do like 4 a month, it's like they go by pretty quick. You know, so yeah, I got lots of good stuff coming up. Trying to plan, you know, get this kind of this thing kind of worked out and scheduled. And I'm starting to get people who want to come on, whereas I used to have to bug people and beg people and whatever. I'm starting to get people that actually are excited to be on the show. So on the podcast, I should say. It's not a show. It's not like we're on ABC or anything like that. Yeah, so I'll announce those guests as the time goes on. What's been happening with me? Haven't done anything after the last Goat Show. What was that? The Motorhead Show? Yeah, after the Motorhead Show, we decided to take a break, take a couple weeks off, and just chill out. You know what I mean? Because we were going pretty heavy with our own shows, and we had the Motorhead thing to get kind of prepared for. And it was a lot of fun, but after that you get kind of burnt out, and I've enjoyed the time off. I've had enough time to actually sit and start writing some songs because I was going through this fucking grinding to a halt fucking writer's block for, God, it must have been about 6 months. Everything I wrote was just a flaming pile of fucking horse shit. Still might be, but at least the songs are getting done now. Before I'd start writing and I'd get about 10 minutes in, or you know what I mean? Just not 10 minutes, like a 10 minute song, but you know what I mean? Like just start doing it. I'd be like, fuck it. I'm done. Don't care. Everything sounds like shit. So I'm not going to do it. So I actually got some ideas down and, I'm writing for the next Goat record. That's what I'm trying to do. I actually got some ideas down and I probably have about 4 new songs, demoed by myself. You know what I mean? I still have to bring them to the band and see how they work. But one thing Goat is good with since we've been together for 7 years is putting an idea from paper to you know, stage, I suppose, if you want to use it that way. Because we all know exactly what we're doing. We know what we want to sound like. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel or anything like that, but as long as we're all having fun. So I'm looking forward to bringing these songs into the band and banging them out. I sent a couple of an acoustic demos to Polly, and he liked them, so cool, man. We're gonna work that out. Gonna start jamming tomorrow again because we have a gig on February 23rd with the Riptides, and yeah, it's gonna be cool. We're gonna try and bring in some old songs that we know. Okay, here's the thing. Goat has 5 full records of material, plus stuff that never got recorded. So we probably have about fucking, God, must be 60 songs. When you play in a punk rock band and you get on a bill with maybe two, three, four, maybe four bands, you only have a 30-minute time slot. You know what I mean? So you're only going to play like 10 songs at a time, maybe. So we got kind of stuck when you have show after show after show. You kind of get used to just... you get a set which you're comfortable with because, you know, we try and put on like not a performance, not like fucking Phantom of the Opera, but we don't just go up there and just song, 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 song. We try to link them together and make it kind of like a big show, right? So we got kind of pocketed or painted ourselves into the corner by the booking that we were doing, that we were playing. Like, we didn't have a lot of time in between shows to actually work out a new set and stuff like that. So we've had about 3 weeks to actually, we're going to have about 3 weeks to actually work on that. And what I was talking about is that back catalog of songs, that 10 song set that we would play would always be kind of the same set, right? The same songs that you're comfortable with. So we're going to go back in the back catalog and pick from the other tons of songs we have and start bringing some of the old stuff back and start mixing up our sets, because for us to have fun too. I think it'll be cool. And I think revisiting a lot of those songs that we haven't probably played live in years will be fun. Or even just to jam them out and see where they go. Maybe we can kind of rework them. You know, it's like the remix. Something like that. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to that. Other than that, that's pretty much all we got on the go. I'm still got some irons in the fire booking the U.S. tour for May. I've reached out to friends in Chicago and New York, and reached out to bars in Cleveland, Detroit, Boston, and it's all looking pretty cool. So we're planning on doing that maybe, well, depending on the dates, but for sure after the first week of May, we'll probably be gone for about 8 days if it all works out, if all the scheduling works out, starting in Toronto, ending in Montreal, going through the States. That way. So keep your ears peeled, because it's kind of tricky to do. You know what I mean? You can book small tours in Canada where you can play like Kingston and Peterborough and Toronto, because they're all in the same kind of pocket. But you start jumping city to city, especially in the U.S. And I've never played in the U.S. before, so this is all new to us. But it was like a bucket list thing. Like, I've been in a band forever, as long as I can remember, and who knows how long you can do it for, right? So I want to say at least at one point I, of course, toured Canada or did even small tours, but I wanted to go on a tour through the U.S. That was a big goal of mine for 2018, and it is coming around, so it's pretty cool. The planning is tough, but I don't know. I'm looking forward to playing those bars and meeting a lot of different bands and meet some new friends and some new contacts. And who knows? Maybe we'll do it once a year or something like that. Too old to do it twice a year. Anyway, that's pretty much all that's going on with me, I guess. I have a guest in the studio today. His name is Jason Watts. He's one of my really good friends, one of my best friends, and we've played more music together than fucking anybody I know. He might be a tight competition with Mike the drummer from Goat, but who knows. He's not here yet. He's coming in shortly. So, yeah, I'm gonna play a song. Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna play a track from a band called the Deadweights. I've played some of their stuff on Ego and Vice before, but it was probably about 6 months ago or so. So I figure, you know. Plus, I think they're a rad band. So you can get a hold of Deadweights at deadweights.bandcamp.com. This is a song off of their 2017 record. It's called Mountain Arresting. This is a song called Pipe Dreams and Broken Things. Soon as the Deadweights are done, we're coming back in the studio with my good friend Jason Watts. We'll be right back. So that was a song called Pipe Dreams and Broken Things by a local band called Deadweights. I think that band is rad. I've seen them play live, and they've been on Ego and Vice before, but I figured I'd give them another shout out. That was off a record that they released in 2017 called Mountain Arresting. You can find Deadweights at deadweights.bandcamp.com. Okay, this is episode 20 of Ego and Vice. Like I said a little while ago, I led into this. I have a guest in the studio tonight. He's one of my best friends in the world, one of my oldest friends too, in this stage of my life. He's a local musician, he's a teacher, he's a student, he's a husband, he's a father of two dogs, and he is an active member of the Ottawa music scene. His name is Jason Watts. What's going on, Jay?
Hey, man, how's it going?
I'm well. What's going on with you? You got lots on the go. You just played a crazy show with your cover band.
Yeah, Bytown Lights. We played over at the beautiful Live on Elgin on Saturday night that just passed. It was a sellout, which was a beautiful thing, but a tough thing to deal with at the same time because with capacity issues and stuff, you unfortunately have to turn away some loving fans and friends and family at the door. And we had a lineup to get in that lasted basically all night long. It's a great problem to have when you do a sellout, but it's also kind of hard at the same time.
I know. With my ego, I went there because I wanted to check you guys out, and I'm standing at the door, and I was probably standing at the door for about 2 minutes, and I was like, this is fucking bullshit, man. What am I even doing here? No. We're going to touch on Bytown Lights because I'm curious of how that band kind of got started. Me and Jay have been, like we were touching each other before, but absolutely. What we were touching on before was how long me and Jay have known each other in Ottawa and how many different projects and bands that we've actually been in. I think, like I said, I think I've played more music with you in a whole bunch of different projects than I have with anybody in my life.
And same goes with me.
Yeah, so I think we have a lot of story to tell, or Jay has a lot of story to tell with me sticking my fucking fat face in it once in a while. But let's start at the beginning.
All right.
You're from Ottawa?
Yep, born and raised.
And you're a drummer?
I am.
Did you always want to be a drummer? Like, where did the drumming come from?
No, I didn't necessarily always want to be a drummer. I didn't actually start playing drums until the end of high school. I think I graduated high school and then kind of fell into it. Through high school, I was much more into hip hop because that's what all the cool kids in my eyes were listening to.
Yeah, as well.
Yeah, and I loved classic hip hop. I was all into DJing. So at the time during high school, I was an aspiring scratch battle DJ. My DJ name was DJ 187.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the cop killer code?
Yeah, it's the police code for homicide.
That's gangster.
I know. I thought it was pretty deep at the time.
Yeah.
I would DJ at high school parties and silly things like that. And then, how did it happen? Graduated high school. My interest started to shift. Started hanging out at this place called the Elbow Room on Elgin Street. Doesn't exist anymore, but rubbing elbows with musicians. And then I had rhythm in me, so I went out and bought myself a djembe, which is like a big bongo-looking thing.
Sure, yeah.
And then started messing around on that, and one thing led to another. Ended up with a drum set, and here we are 20 years later.
Cool. So I guess when you bought the drum kit, you brought it home to Craig, your dad, whom I know very well.
Yep.
And you just set it up and said, this is happening now. This is my thing now.
Yeah. So I guess my very first kick at the can as a quote unquote drummer was a work Christmas party. I worked at this place out in Orleans at the time called Builder's Warehouse, sort of a Home Depot type place. Mm-hmm. And a few of the guys out in the lumber yard were musicians, played guitar, bass, and they were like, oh, we need a drummer. And I'm like, oh, I've been kind of messing around on the bongos. Let me give it a shot, because there was no other drummers. So they just had to settle. So I went out.
Stuck with me.
I went out and rented a drum set and put it in my dad's basement, my parents' basement. We started jamming. And, one of the first songs I learned how to play in front of people. My goodness, what were they? One of them was Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton. Hmm. Another one was Kryptonite. Three Doors Down.
Three Doors Down, that's right.
Yeah. Anyway, there was six songs in the set, and learned those and played them probably quite terribly. Thankfully, there isn't any film of that.
Right.
And yeah, that was my first kick.
Did your instrument, did drumming come easy to you? Like, I think back on playing guitar when I first started, and it was like pulling teeth on, like, for a long time. And I'm still, like I said, I've used this before, but I've worked 20 years to be this mediocre. You know what I mean? Like, because you, to me, you're a smooth drummer. You have fluidity. You have knowledge of the kit. Like, did it come naturally, or did you have to work hard for it?
Well, I think I naturally had a lot of rhythm in me for unknown reasons. No one in my family's musical, but just from the years of DJing, it just kind of established a good sense of rhythm, and how rhythm worked and how measures were structured. And I don't know, it did come kind of easy to me, but it's not as though the first time I sat behind a kit, I was as good as I am right now.
No.
I had to work hard, and I sucked for a long time. You know, until things started getting better, basically just with hours of practice and playing gigs and tanking a bunch of shows. And
sure.
Yeah.
So after, okay, you have the drum kit, that band that didn't have a drummer got stuck with you for that gig or whatever it was.
Yeah, they did.
When did you start, like, actually, when did you form, like, your first band or join your first band, or what was, like, your first, okay, this is my thing now, like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Prior to joining our first project together, Our Mistake, before that I was just kind of playing with anybody that would let me. So there wasn't anything really serious before Our Mistake came around. There was a bunch of projects. I think I was in like 7 or 8 bands, but none of them were serious. They play like one show a year. We'd get together and rehearse some covers, maybe a couple of originals. Actually, before Our Mistake, now that the juices are flowing, there was this thing... Project Gold.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
Project Gold, yeah.
I remember... What was the guy who played saxophone? What was his name?
Spaghetti or something? No.
No, that's the bass player for Hell Bros. Anyway.
Yeah, a phenomenal sax player. Just his name is escaping me. He had, like, green hair, I think.
Moose or... Anyway, so on. Proceed. Sorry.
Yeah, Project Gold. So anyway, I was just hopping from band to band, project to project, and Brian Ruxtel, who Ohio and I both have history with, he was a booker and a prominent member of the Elbow Room family, and then he had the opportunity to open up his own spot, Cafe to Cuff. So being friends with Brian, I ended up kind of going over there, and through that place, Brian and some friends of his formed a group called Project Gold. Nothing really serious came out of it. Some pretty cool music. Mm-hmm. So I think I was DJing in that band. I think I was like a scratch DJ in that band.
I think you were. I think I saw that band actually at Barrymore's once.
Maybe, yeah. You know, it was very sort of jam band, Linkin Park, sort of Limp Bizkit flavor with like a bit of Incubus thrown in.
Now, I'm combing the back of my brain, which is full of gunk and black stuff. Weren't you in a band called like Chicanery or something like that?
Yeah, a cover duo, Chicane.
Chicane.
Me and a guy who's still doing it. He's still doing the acoustic cover thing. He's into it, you know, every weekend. His name's James Hawley. Yeah, him and I jammed together. There was Project Gold. Sort of at the tail end of high school in my DJ days, there was this band called Stumble, where I was the DJ.
Well, I remember that band. I remember the name.
Yeah,
Stumble. What about you were in the Junkyard thing too?
Yeah, that was another one of those moments where I was just kind of hopping around.
Remember these things for Jay over the course of the interview.
Yeah. you know, hopping around with any group that would let me. I was with the Junkyard Symphony for a bit of time. I didn't do any of the like school shows. He does a ton of like elementary school shows, which are super cool. Yeah. Kids love it. But at the time that I was in the band, he was playing a lot of bigger venues like Barrymore's. And I remember going on tour, just shooting up the 401 and playing a gig in Guelph with the Junkyard Symphony at Guelph University during the SARS crisis.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And I was just so scared. I didn't even want to drive through Toronto. I wanted to hold my breath the whole time we were driving past Toronto because I was afraid I was going to catch SARS.
I'm going to get the SARS.
The SARS. I was terrified.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, as you kind of start to think back and recall.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many dots there are to the journey, you know?
Well, yeah, just how often do you sit back and actually think about this shit, right?
I've never sat back and taken stock of all the different projects.
Sit tight, sir, because I got a roller coaster for you. Anyway, so as we're getting closer to when we met, we've touched on some of your history, and we don't have to kick the shit out of the early stuff by any means. You said Brian was working at the Elbow Room, and then somehow along the lines, and I don't know that history, and that's his story to tell unless you know it, he ended up at Café de Cuff, which is a bar on Rideau Street, where he was the sound guy on at that bar. And you were working there too as part-time sound guy, security, renaissance man of the venue.
Yeah, hosted the Wednesday night open stage as well.
That's right. That's cool. And then the way this came together for me is I knew Brian through an ex-girlfriend I had because they grew up together in Rockland. And she had talked to Brian and booked some time for me to come in because I had all these acoustic songs. Because I was in a punk band earlier in Ottawa, and then that broke up, and then I was toiling for a while. I gave up music. I said, I'm going to be like a fucking accountant or something. I didn't say that, but it could have happened. And I wrote all these acoustic songs because I always had it in me, and she talked to Brian, and he ended up booking some time, and he recorded me just live off the floor. And that's how I met Brian. And then after I did my second EP, and I'm jumping ahead, just acoustic EP, I came into Brian, Café de Cuff on a Friday or Saturday night, and I had met you at this point, but just in passing. Hey, man, what's going on? And I went up to him, and I had a few beers. I'm like, hey, man, I knew you were in Project Gold. He was in Project Gold. I said, do you want to start a side project? And he's like, okay. And it's like, I can play guitar. You can play guitar. We use my songs and your songs. And then I was like, well, we need a drummer. And he went, he's a drummer. And he pointed at you.
Yep.
And that was the kind of birth of our mistake.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember that time?
I do. It was a long time ago, though, man. You know, the fog of time has set in, making things a little bit hazy of how it all came together. But yeah, I remember I would hang out at Café de Cuff all the time. It was the hot new spot in town. You know, it was the first time that I had experienced, because I was young then. I was only like 19 years old, basically, when all this was going down. 19, maybe 20.
So I was still old.
You were. Yes, yes, you were. Yeah. And anyway, so all this was new to me, but going to the Elbow Room, you know, it was always a great time there, always full. I mean, the room was the size of a walk-in closet, but it was always full, hence the name Elbow Room. Mm. And everybody had a great time. But then when Brian went over and opened up Café de Cuff, it was just like the hot new spot. Like, I remember the open stages were packed, and not just packed with musicians, but packed with people coming out to hear live music. And it was packed for months, not just the first night or two, you know, like it was packed for months. Mm-hmm. And they would get like some pretty big name acts that would get in there and play, you know, and being in an intimate venue, and the sound in there at the time was fantastic, and the venue looked super cool. And I think when it first opened, you could still smoke in bars.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You could. I remember.
So that was glorious.
Café de Cuff, to anyone who listens to this, it's a, you know, who's been to Café de Cuff now. Café de Cuff now and Café de Cuff when it first opened is two completely different places.
Completely different places.
Yeah. It's a cool place to go now. It's kind of a dive bar now where you go in and you can play your punk rock songs or your rock show and stuff like that. It's kind of cold and whatever. I'm not talking shit about the venue. I'm not talking shit about anything. I'm just telling it the way I know it and remember it.
I got more wrinkles in my face now than I did 15 years ago.
Yeah. But I remember when that place first opened, it was like had seats and booths, and it was shiny and new, and you could order food, and you could sit, and you can eat, and it was just like this kind of loungy, kind of cool little room and stuff like that. And
it was great.
Yeah, it's amazing how that changed. So anyway, our mistake started. It was the three of us. I can't remember. Maybe you can. I can't remember when we started jamming, but we actually started jamming at Café de Cuff.
Yeah, that was our rehearsal space.
Which was pretty rad. And all you kids who play Café de Cuff nowadays, look at us old guys and say, this used to be our jam spot, okay?
Yeah, we would tear that place up through one rehearsal, the carnage left behind. Oh, my God.
So, do you remember if we jammed at all? Like, just the three of us? We must have. And then we were looking for a bass player, and we brought in...
Yeah. I think we jammed, you know, informally, maybe once, just to get an idea of some sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we pretty much opened up the spot for a bass player like right away.
Right.
Now I don't remember how, like, who had the connection to Rodney Nelson.
Brian knew him from somewhere. I don't know how or where, but he knew this. I remember it was a conversation, and this is completely probably not completely accurate, but it was like, hey, I know a guy who plays bass who I can talk to, and this is like 2003-ish, so it's not like you'd shoot him a text or whatever. It's like, I don't know, they talked on the phone? Or
yeah, no, it's coming back now, you okay. know, as the memories come flooding back. Brian and Rodney knew each other from when Brian was a booker. Because I remember Rodney played in a band. I think they were
The Haunting.
The Haunting.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The Haunting.
The goth band.
Yeah. So Brian and Rodney had crossed paths musically mm-hmm. a couple of times in the past.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I remember we were sitting at the Cuff, and I remember I had never met him, and he said, yeah, he's a good dude. And he showed up at one of the band practices, and we're like, okay. And you get an image in your brain of somebody, and this is just my memory. I'm waiting for this, like, well, they're bass players, right? They're all kind of weird.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for this, like, little scrawny kind of guy. And this big guy
yeah.
had to been. Rodney's a big dude. He's got to yeah. be about 6-something, maybe 200 and something pounds.
He enjoys a cheeseburger here.
Big dude walks in. He's like, hey, what's up? I'm like, okay, cool, man. Yeah. So that was the band. That's when Our Mistake started.
Was he wearing the orange pants that day?
I can't remember. It's all an orange blur, actually.
It is, yeah.
Did he ever not wear those pants?
I don't know. They were great pants. They were very risky, very fashion forward pants.
Yeah, well, man, Rodney was who he was. You know, he was just Rodney. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, we started playing, and I think we got good enough or got confident enough to book a show.
Yep.
At Cafe de Cuff.
Yeah, first one was de Cuff. Yeah, I remember that show very well. I remember one specific moment of that show very well.
Yeah.
That moment involves you. I don't know if you remember that moment.
Is that when I fell down on stage?
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly was.
Our very first show, I'm like, okay, Mike, keep it cool, man. This is a fucking big deal.
Place was packed. It was like sold out. It was just bonkers yeah. in there.
And I think it was like during the first song, I tried to do the old Billy Joe from Green Day, kind of jump, tuck my knees up into my chest and do that last ring out. Prang! Came down on top of the monitor, went ass over tea kettle over the monitor. And
I could have sworn that you did the like rock star jump to land on the beat, and you ended up landing on like a rat's nest of cables, and then the cables just rolled out from under your feet like a banana peel in a cartoon.
Yeah, that's fair. I never did. You know, it's been like fucking 15 years. I've never really have perfected that jump. And this is super jumping ahead into another story. But remember, it was like 3 months ago at Coast of Targ when Hearts and Minds was playing.
Yeah.
And I totally missed the cue on the song Sick.
Absolutely.
And I just jumped and it was complete silence. Yep. And then it fucking yeah. So yep. I never did really perfect that jump, so thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome.
But it's the effort, kids.
It is.
It's the fucking effort.
It looks cool, but you know, it's cooler if it lands on time.
Mm-hmm. So Our Mistake kept going, and Our Mistake was together for quite a while.
Yep.
Can you recall some of your some good Our Mistake stories, or what it was like at that time for you to be a drummer who had always kind of jumped around looking for something, and then all of a sudden had this established band for you?
It felt really cool to be part of something, especially with like the owner or part owner of a bar, and having that establishment as a place that we could call home. To have that sort of home base as a bar, I thought was really, really cool. I identified a lot with the place. And then, you know, the guys in the band, we were always joking around, and our chemistry was great. You know, we really enjoyed each other's company, and we wrote some reasonably decent music, I thought, at the time. It was a great time in my life, for sure. Stories, goodness, let me think.
Well... for me, it was my kind of experience of that era was kind of like, because even though I'd been in bands like since like the, because I'm old as fuck, like since the mid 90s and shit, then moving from Thunder Bay to Ottawa and being in bands, I didn't know any really thing about what it was like to be in a band. It's like, oh, I got a show out of the community center or something like that, and you go play, and then 3 months later you played in a gymnasium, and all of a sudden you're in like a bar. And Brian was very tapped into like the business side of music even back then, right? So he was the one who said. And I still use a lot of his advice or his techniques, or I don't know if you call them techniques, but today, you know what I mean? So yeah. I learned a lot from that era. Same where way. We were actually playing bars and we were using some strategy or some good business,
yep.
you know, thing to actually try and make the band go places.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Trying to build a foundation, build a fan base, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of market rule don't oversaturate your home market or any market for that matter, you know, so you got to space out your shows in certain cities so that you don't, you know, fizzle out any buzz that you might get going from your previous show.
Right. We did some Ottawa stuff. I think we did some, maybe this was later on, but I think we did some Toronto stuff.
Yeah.
But we also, in that era, we recorded two CDs or two records.
Yep, two full length records. Yeah.
Yeah. One was the Black and White record, which was recorded up at Skylark Park back when it was called French Kiss Studios in Pembroke with our good pal
Jordan,
Mr. Jay-Z, Jordan Zadorozny. Rodney ended up not being in the band after a while, and again, you know, we're not going to get into any crazy details. It's just we're young and stupid, and things came first, and we thought this was the right thing to do, and blah 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 blah. Long story short, and long
yada yada yada.
The first record or CD that we made was completed. It was basically the three of us, and Jordan ended up filling in on the bass on that one.
Yeah,
and yeah, it was cool. I think the first part of that was basically like the first idea of the which will lead into a different story here of our mistake. The first CD or the first chunk of music was like, because Brian had a whole bunch of acoustic songs and I had a bunch of acoustic songs, and we kind of mashed them together to make this Black and White CD.
Yeah, we were going for like some edgier version of Blue Rodeo.
Right. Yeah, there was a lot of like mid-tempo kind of rocky stuff. Some I think originally in that band, I just played acoustic guitar.
Yeah. And just having two singers that have two different voice types, you know, mashing together, sometimes singing just a song by themselves, or sometimes you guys would like share chunks of the song back and forth between you.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's exactly what it was. And then I eventually graduated to playing my electric guitar, and that's when we kind of started to take the band in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, we started to grow instead of being, two units coming together and being sort of, for lack of a better term, a little bit schizophrenic musically, we started to grow into one sort of, you know.
And we actually started writing songs from scratch. There was nothing old. It was all like, let's do this.
Yeah.
So it's cool. But before we get into that chapter of our mistake, let's play something off of the Black and White CD record. What would you like to hear?
Off the first record, I'd have to say that probably my fondest memory, one of the songs that, like, I remember when you're writing a song with a band, every once in a while you come across a song where, as it's being written and, like, once you kind of rip through it for the first time, you get that kind of gut feeling, the goosebumps or the butterflies or whatever. And I remember there was this one track that you wrote when we were first playing it back in the day, and the first time we actually, like, completed it and played it all the way through. And on that last ring out, the big last ring out of the song, I was like, this song could take us somewhere. This song is pretty incredible. So for me, I would say that song would be Nothing Left to Fear.
Oh, cool, man. Thanks for the nice words.
No problem.
But, you know, I think it's all the drums that make it good. stroking, my friend.
Yeah.
So let's listen to that. Let's listen to this song called Nothing Left to Fear, which features Mr. J. Watts on drums, Mr. fucking Monkey Brain on lead vocals. And this song, I'll just have a little touch on it too, is kind of the way we ended up kind of writing the next one.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know. Yeah. It had more of like a swing, more of a heavy groove to it.
Yeah.
And this was kind of a fun song for me too, because I'd always written three chord punk stuff.
Yeah.
And this was the first one where I was drop D and I was starting to use different kind of techniques.
You discovered the fourth chord.
Yeah, fuck. Yeah. Who knew, man?
Yeah, there's a fourth chord, ladies and gentlemen, and cool. He found it.
Yeah. So this is a song called Nothing Left to Fear. It's off of the Armistice record, the Black and White record. I don't fuck it. Whatever. Here it is.
Felt like I died inside, but I survived.
So that was Nothing Left to Fear, a song I wrote, God, must have been 15 years ago, I think.
Easily.
Yeah, and I don't know. Like I said, the first Our Mistake record was very... what we just talked about. Listen back to what we just fucking said. So we moved on to the next phase, what we also talked about, where we wanted to kind of write from scratch and start building songs that weren't around forever. And I think we did a pretty good job. What do you remember from the writing process of that?
Well, the writing process that that worked is that, you know, from week to week, you and Brian, being both sort of lead vocalists, would take turns kind of coming forward with an idea. Whether it be just sort of a maybe it would turn out to be a chorus with some words, or sometimes you'd come in with almost a fully crafted song, but they were new, they were current, they weren't like reaching back into some volume of a diary from 12 years ago. You know, they were current experiences and inspirations and stuff. And occasionally we would even just end up jamming a riff in the room. And all of a sudden it would start to form into a verse and a chorus. And before you know it, some words and sounds and oohs and ahs are starting to get tossed out, and boom, you got a track. So, I mean, we did it every which way.
I remember that time period being very, very creative and also very competitive. That was the first time I'd ever written with somebody, but me and Brian never actually wrote together. It was just like he would bring in a song and I'd be like, fuck, that's good.
Yeah.
And then I'd go home and I'd be like, I have to make a good one too.
Yeah.
So I would just sit there and I had just this competitive kind of like, okay, I'm going to try on this. And then I'd bring in a song. But for some reason, they were just all, I don't remember a lot of like throwaways from that time period either. It's like everything that came in kind of got used and kind of flourished and stuff.
Yeah, it did.
And it got to the point when we ended up releasing our second one called Sleeping with the Kill Squad. There's songs that didn't even make it. Like we had leftovers.
Yeah, we did.
Which some of them were staples of the live show, like the song like Situations.
Yep.
Is that what it's called?
Situations, yeah. Situations Killing Me. I don't know. Brackets, yeah. Killing
and
Me.
And then maybe not a staple of the live show, but just a song that was kicking around for a long time was the Blue Collar Poetry.
Beautiful song, man.
Yeah,
beautiful
and song. Just like we had so much.
That song brought tears to my eyes, man. Yeah. That was a beautiful song.
It probably wouldn't now if you listened to it.
Yeah, I was an emotional...
But at the time, it was fucking deep, bud.
I was a delicate flower back then.
But I remember... But at this point, we ended up getting a new bass player, too.
Yep. Yeah, we did.
And his name was Adam.
It was.
And...
I think we got him off the internet.
Not internet. He answered an ad we hung up at Steve's Music.
So this was like pre-internet.
Well, I think the internet was around, but yeah. No, it wasn't like it was today, yeah, right?
There wasn't a spot for that.
But I remember we... made a flyer and it was either Songbird Music on Gladstone or it was Steve's Music, and we did the whole thing looking for bass player, and we did the little dangly numbers at the bottom.
Yeah, the little octopus fingers at the bottom.
And I think it was Brian's number, and he called Brian and somehow they hooked up, and we said we should go meet this guy, and I think we went and had a beer with him.
Yeah, at the Blackburn Arms.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
And then he came in and he's stuck around for a few years anyway. He was a good dude. He was fucking... Me and Adam, on a personal level... never, like, at first we kind of hit it off, we didn't know each other, but then we had kind of like an oil and water kind of a relationship. But he was I'll give this one thing to Adam, he was a great fucking bass player.
Amazing bass player.
And he had some great ideas, and he had a great ear for what we were doing, and he would just put in parts. I remember being in the studio with Adam, pardon me, and it's like when you're playing music with people in a basement or in a jam spot, just like you hear what you hear. Okay. And this is probably the same thing for anybody who's, unless you're a super stickler for every little fucking control freak type of thing, but you'd hear what he's playing. It's like, oh yeah, it all sounds good. But then you get in the studio and you hear their isolated parts where he's standing in front of you and he's playing his bass thing. And I was like, holy fuck, that's awesome.
Is that what you actually do in the song? And then he'd be like, yeah, that's what I do. That's what I've always done. And you're just like, come on.
Yeah. And I still listen, whenever I do listen to Sleeping with the Kill Squad, the second Our Mistake record, which is rare. But whenever I do listen to it, the bass just punches out at me like, fuck, that made a huge, huge... It almost changed, like, from the first record to the second record, even though we tried to write differently. Just that groove or that mood or that attitude kind of set us, is why that record sounds that way, I think.
Yeah, it became a big part of our sound having Adam. He's a very, I mean, this is what I would say, he's a very sort of lyrical bass player. he creates separate melodies on his bass rather than just sort of supporting root notes. He like takes it somewhere and takes his bass playing on a bit of a journey, but a very respectful journey that just you didn't know that it was always supposed to be there, but he just found a way to put in the coolest shit.
Yeah, stuff like if you ever listen to it, as everyone who's listening to this podcast right now, check your mailbox. Everybody gets a copy. Check under your seat.
All 11 of you.
Yeah, right. But anyway, just saying, if you ever happen to hear it for some fucking strange cosmic reason, and this is kind of hard for me. Well, it's easy for me to say now, but it's kind of, I never would have said this in early in the day, but listen to the bass because it's excellent. Not that the art, like what you did or what Brian did or whatever, the writing wasn't, but that bass playing was just fucking...
It was exceptional.
It was. You and Adam, you guys got along well.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a good guy. Him and I definitely sat well together in the pocket. He would connect well with my playing. And, you know, as a rhythm section, the drummer and the bass player, they have to get along. You know, they don't have to be best friends or brothers or anything like that, but just musically, they have to kind of anticipate where the other one is going. And Adam and I thought were always really good at that.
Right. The pocket. I didn't know what the pocket was until our mistake. I just figured plug in and play, and as long as you don't fall off the stage, you're good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
With me and Adam, I think it was, maybe I'm a hard guy to know. I don't know. I was pretty close to Rodney, the first bass player, and then shit kind of went down with that. And then when Adam came in, and I'll admit, I kind of hazed him a bit. I gave him a hard time.
Yeah, it didn't make it easy for him, but
just
because, I mean, that's fine.
You know, you're younger and you kind of have a bit of an ego.
Advice.
You have a bit of an ego and stuff like that. And you're like, okay, this guy's coming into this thing. And we had already put like three years of hard work. And we didn't want him. And we didn't know him. So it's just like, okay, you're coming into this kind of established thing. Like this first show was like at Barrymore's or something like that, which was like, okay. So for some strange fucking immature, egotistical attitude-y whatever, I just kind of, I felt like he needed to earn his place.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he never presented himself as somebody who felt like he was getting a free ride or anything like that. But if Adam, you're listening, I'm not sorry for any of it. I wouldn't change a thing. I'm just trying to tell my story.
Yeah.
Or Jay's trying to tell it. This is Jay's episode. Listen to me talking.
This is my episode, yeah. Ohio's filling in all my stories.
Sorry, dude.
That's all right. Go for it. It's your spot.
No, it's just, yeah. But I think, do you remember Hope? We played Hope.
Yeah, man. That was... Hope. Hope was my my personal first experience at quote unquote making it big, and I'm doing the sort of air quotes. You know,
huge. It was huge.
It was huge. Mm-hmm. It was such a big deal, man. To get up there, to be one of the opening bands for Hope was like, in terms of like the Ottawa music scene, it was a big deal, and getting that opportunity is one of the fondest memories that I have from playing, for sure.
Sure.
Laura Andrews, our good friend Laura, you know, she's been a staple in pretty much all of our musical endeavors. But she was a huge supporter of Our Mistake and of all local music for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And she definitely helped bring us along on a pretty cool ride for a few years there.
She's also the silent money partner of Southwood Studios, where this show takes place.
That is true.
But don't tell anybody. We took the band into Halifax, which we've always talked about as friends, as just we were asked because the Hope Fest did a show in Halifax, and we were asked, you guys want to do that? And we're like, okay.
Of course.
So we ended up loading up a cube van and I think we had to take down a whole bunch of Hope, like
volleyball
nets and shit.
The only reason why they let us play is because we were glorified delivery drivers.
But
hey, man, rock and roll. We got to do it.
And we went down there and we played that show, and all the Hope crew made us feel very welcome.
The biggest stage I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was a massive stage.
It was the biggest stage. Yeah.
I think that was your first experience with wireless.
Oh, yeah. Fuck yeah.
That was a good
time.
So
silly.
That was a good time.
Who was I?
And he was running laps around the drum riser. The stage was so big, the drum riser was like in the middle of this like giant square 60-foot stage. So there was like room to put a whole other band on the backside of the stage facing the other way. There wasn't.
Yeah.
But Ohio was just running around doing laps around my drum riser while I'm playing. It was a good time. It was a ton of energy playing on Citadel Hill in downtown Halifax.
Yeah, it was a huge party, and it was late night shenanigans.
Yep, and lots of late night shenanigans.
Milk crates down the hill, and it was
lots of time. One story that I have of that is at the time I was working at Cafe de Cuff, and you know, you're all friends at Cafe de Cuff. I worked there. I was friends with the bartenders, so I would order rounds like of shots, let's say at Cafe de Cuff for friends of mine when they'd come out. And get like a wicked deal. You know, I'd pay cost on the bottles. It was peanuts. And I got a few into me on one of our late night shenanigans. And I remember we were going around in a group of like 15 or 20 people or something, like a bunch of people from Hope and maybe some people we met down there.
Yeah.
And then I decide to be a hero and not thinking that there's financial ramifications. I tell the bartender I want to buy a round of shots. I think they were like B-52s or something.
What, for the whole bar?
For our group.
Oh, I see.
It's like 20 people. And so they pour the shots, and I'm feeling like a big, big deal, and take the shots, and I don't know, 20 minutes later, we're looking to bring the show to the next bar, and the bartender brings me my bill, and it's like, I don't know, $300 or something.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, there goes all my spending money for the like entire 4 or 5 days. Like, I've got no money left, and this is like night one. So it was an unfortunate situation.
We're totally skewing the timeline, too, because this is when Rodney was still in the band.
Rodney was in the band. This was first record territory.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
So, anyway, in our friend group, we always look back on that trip, and we always bring it up, because so many people were involved that we're all still friends with crew. We all still kind of know each other.
Yep.
So, it was a huge thing for us, and it was a lot of fun. And regardless of the music, if I look back on that as something we did as friends, you know what I mean? Always remember that. Doesn't matter. Getting back to Our Mistake, though, or to Sleeping with the Kill Squad, the second record. We were kind of getting towards the end, though,
yep,
of that band. We played a bunch of shows in Toronto. We had a showcase gig for, I think it was the Agency Group.
Yep.
At the Rivoli.
Yep.
In TO, where we had to play, I think our stage time was like 20 minutes.
Yeah, 20 minutes total.
Teardown, setup.
And music, with all within that 20-minute bracket.
Yeah. Get out.
It was ridiculous.
I think we played about 3 songs.
If that. I think we got through like halfway through the third one, and they pulled out the red and white striped hook.
The big hook
they
came up.
Pulled us off stage. Yeah, something like that. It was part of a big showcase festival or something. I don't remember.
Yeah. And
we went to Canadian Music Week.
Oh, yeah, right.
We did that. We got a hotel. I think that was the first time I tried pho.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was a good time. Learned all kinds of stuff. Did all the seminars. Mm-hmm. Saw a bunch of cool rock shows. Went and saw Edwin as like a bartender.
Hmm.
At, I forget, what was the name of that club? Like Tattoo Parlor or something? Anyway.
No idea. At this point, we had accomplished a lot, but there were some issues within the band. Me and Adam, like I said, weren't getting along.
Yeah.
Brian was starting to want to do other things.
Yep.
And he's, like I said, he's always been kind of business. He's a great performer. He's a great musician, but his brain is more on the creative side and the business side of it. So I'm not speaking for him. This is just my story or our story.
Yeah.
Just my memory. And it felt like he was kind of starting to put one foot out the door, and there was kind of some tension in between the band. And then I remember we didn't jam for a while, and then we ended up sitting down at Laura's old place, because yep. Laura Andrews was our manager at the time.
Yep.
And we had our meeting,
mm-hmm.
and that was the end of that.
It was the week after Canadian Music Week.
Okay.
As I remember it anyway, it was like a week or two after Canadian Music Week. We had fairly recently just picked up all the boxes of Sleeping with the Kill Squad.
It was fresh, yeah. It was something
fresh.
Like that. Yeah.
Like the boxes still felt like freshly wrapped cellophane.
I still have 2 full boxes in my back room, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, ladies and gentlemen, just mail in to Ego and Vice, and you'll get your very own copy of Sleeping with the Kill Squad.
You will. Everyone gets a copy.
The sort of unfortunate thing, I guess, is that, in my opinion, there's a lot of really great music on that record. Mm. And if our batteries were sort of recharged, and if we had the same sort of get up and go as we did off the first record, I think that Sleeping with the Kill Squad, you know, could have helped us get to the sort of next level, you know, being quote unquote a little bit more serious.
Yeah, if like I said, in that creative process, which we had touched on earlier, if we had carried that out and we didn't let other things get in the way, but it's band, it's life, shit happens, right?
Yep, it is what it is.
But it's, yeah, it's curious to wonder if we would have kept riding that wave. And a bunch of years later, we tried to write a next one. Me and Brian did it, and then you came in and did drums, and Brian didn't want to use real drums, so we replaced your drums with some,
yeah, thanks for that,
fucking electronic drums. But awesome. I'm not blaming Brian for that, because I was just like, whatever, dude, yeah, fine. And those songs were okay, but they didn't, like I said, they weren't from that. It wasn't the four guys in the room.
No,
it was like two guys sitting in front of a computer kind of making this thing, and you listen to them, they're kind of lifeless, they don't have the same energy, they don't have anything. But hey, man, it's out there. I still have that somewhere, too, but no one's ever going to hear that one just because it's not worth it.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting at that meeting, the last meeting, and it was just, there was like a hope of like, okay, we can pull this together. But then me and Adam were at such odds, and I remember just looking at him going, I never want to see your fucking face again. I never want to play music with you again, and blah, blah, blah. And
I'm pretty sure you said that to his face.
I did. I said it right to his face. Yeah. And
yeah,
that was probably, I think I saw him out at the bar a couple more times over the last fucking 10 years, and he just kind of looks at me and goes, it's gone. But what do you have to say?
Yeah.
So that was the end of Armstick.
That was it. Yeah. Turn the page.
What did you do after that? How did you feel when that? Where were you? I knew where I was. I was ready to kind of like get away from it and stuff. But how were you feeling at that point?
Well, you know, that, like I said, that Armistake was my first sort of really serious project. So seeing it slowly kind of fizzle out and die was tough. It was hard for me. It stopped being fun for a little while, you know, for several months anyway. It was no longer fun to get together and jam. Mm-hmm. There was so much politics and sort of bitterness and tension in the air. Just, it wasn't fun. For me, music is always an escape, and it wasn't fun anymore. So when it finally did sort of extinguish, it was sad, but I saw it coming. The writing was on the wall for a long time. So when it ended, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't have this like grand plan where I was like, oh, I'm going to turn the page and then this is going to happen. Like, I had no idea. I think I ended up just kind of taking a break, just like stopping music altogether, just taking a break, trying to let the spark reignite naturally. I didn't want to force anything. So I just, you know, kind of stopped, just sort of secluded myself and chilled out for a bit.
Yeah, as one does. I, on the other hand, immediately wanted to jump back into something else, but that's another story. Before we get to that, let's play something off Sleeping with the Kill Squad.
All right. All right, let's see here. There's so many great songs, and this is a tough one here.
Keep in mind, it's my podcast.
Touche. Well, regardless of that, I would say one of the coolest songs off that record. There's many, many cool songs. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about the one song where a certain namesake kind of comes from, which we won't play because it's very, very long. But
let me just touch on that really quick. Yeah. There was a song on Sleeping with the Kill Squad that I wrote. It was called Ego and Vice.
Yep.
So
track 10.
It was my attempt at some kind of weird metal thing. I don't know what happened there, but
yeah. And the great thing was that I had just bought a double kick pedal because those were a big deal, and I was like, I'm going to put in as much double kick pedal on this record as I can. And I did it tastefully, but for some weird reason, it just always ended up working super good on Ohio's tracks.
Yeah, well.
And I'm pretty sure that one features a little bit of double kick.
It does. So that's where Ego and Vice came from.
Yeah, but anyway, the song that I want to hear right now is kind of like a word painting song that you did, you know, where it really kind of takes the listener on a bit of a journey. It paints a picture. It's a song called Quarantine.
Right.
Quarantine. I don't know if you want me to tell kind of what it's about. But I think that song is cool as shit.
Well, it's a song about Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just an amazing, wacky, crazy dude.
Very innovative, very groundbreaking guy when it came to aviation, among other things. Rich, eccentric. Very, very interesting dude.
Very interesting.
So this is a song called Quarantine off of Armistake's second record, Sleeping with the Kill Squad. It's about Howard Hughes. The song is called Quarantine. A song called Quarantine off the second Our Mistake record, Sleeping with the Kill Squad. Jay Watts is in the studio. This is going to be a two-parter just because me and Jay have just kind of started to scratch the surface on his history or our history together. The show is very much dedicated to Jay, but we have a lot of, like I said, we have a lot of history together. So I said I'm going to punch my opinion in here and there. But anyway. Part two will probably be posted next week at some time, or maybe in the next few days, depending how fast I get to the editing. Stay tuned for that. If you want to get a hold of me, you can contact me at egoandvice@gmail.com. If you want to be on the show, if you want me to play some of your songs on the show, or you even want to come in and sit in at Southwood Studio and we can have a chat, and I can make an episode all about you. You can also check out egoandvice.com. Every podcast is there where you can just listen to them for free. Check it out. Go to Facebook. Give me a like. Give me a share. It helps. And tell your friends. Okay, this has been episode 20 of Ego and Vice with Jay Watts. We'll see you next week for episode 21, part 2. See y'all.
You've got a real attitude problem, McFly. You're a slacker.